Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us now is my good friend, Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm, Capital Alpha Partners, who joins us pretty regularly to give us his sense on the week ahead and whatever else is on his mind. Byron, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here, Vago.
Great to have you back on as always. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Byron, Biden administration obviously is working to fill itself out. It's pressing ahead with a big stimulus package that could be so large and partisan that it makes future deals on infrastructure and defense harder. But first, as you do when you join us, give us a look at the week ahead and what you think folks should be paying attention to.
Well, I think, you know, the two things to watch that I think are, you know, some are scheduled and some are unscheduled. Let's talk about the unscheduled first, because you talked about this on the Friday podcast, Vago, but I think one issue is going to be who winds up on some of these Senate subcommittees, particularly the Senate Armed Services and the Senate Defense Appropriations Subcommittee. And then the other kind of to be determined pacing event is going to be who else will the Biden administration put forth for senior Department of Defense positions? I think the only one who's really been confirmed is Secretary of Defense Austin, but there's 61 other positions that that the president will nominate and the Senate has to confirm. So, you know, we know Kath Hicks is one, and we know we've got DOD policy as well, but that, you know, that still leaves a large number of positions that are going to be important to fill out. And that in turn, I think, will help shape, you know, what are some of these new policies and plans of the administration going to be?
Absolutely. And there has been a delay, right? I mean, it's been about 3 weeks since we've heard anybody else named, and all eyes are on what the service secretaries are going to be, certainly what the acquisition folks are going to be, acquisition and sustainment in both research and engineering, right. Obviously, now that those positions have been broken up.
I was going to say on the scheduled events, you know, I think the one that I am most keenly interested in is Atlanta Council is going to do another one of their captains of industry events on Wednesday. But they're going to have on this one, it's going to be a focus on innovation in the industry. They're going to have the CEOs of Anduril, Maxar, and I believe another speaker who are just losing. She may be from Georgetown, if I recall. I'd have to double check on that. But I think it's always good to hear from a particularly relatively new entrance to the defense sector. You know, what are the challenges that they see? You know, how are things going with both Congress and DOD in opening up markets for some of these new competitors? Not that Maxar is a new competitor, but they're kind of in that new space portion of the market. And that'll be, I think, the most important of the DC think tank events this week.
And I think who you're talking to about is former DASD for research, Melissa Flagg, who is now affiliated with Georgetown University, is going to be moderating that conversation. Arnold Pinaro is going to be giving some remarks as well. And it's Dan Yablonsky, who's the president and CEO of Maxar, and Brian Schimpf, who is the co-founder and CEO of Anduril Industries. And generally, when people think about Anduril, obviously they think of Chris Broz and they think Palmer Luckey. Speaking about the industrial base, talk to us and Arnold Pinaro. Arnold is obviously the chairman of the National Defense Industrial Association. Hawk Carlisle last week rolled out the NDIA's annual vital signs. It's the second annual report that they put out on the health of the defense industrial base. And one of the points was that last year's report was a solid C, is what they found. You know, and that was still on a 20% increase in defense spending from 2017 to $394 billion in 2019, right? And that was still a solid C. This year, they gave a solid C again to the industry, saying that it was weaker because of the pandemic. What were your key takeaways on that report? How should policymakers and everybody in this community be regarding it?
Look, I think it's required reading for anybody who's interested in this sector. I mean, it really is, I think, a massive amount of work. I'm glad to see that NDIA does this. I know, Frank Kendall, when he was AT&L at Department of Defense, also used to put out what I thought were pretty interesting reviews of how acquisition policy was going. There's an annual defense industrial base assessment that's put out by the DoD as well. But this really kind of gets into the guts of what's going on in the industrial base. Not too surprisingly, I think some of the areas that they thought things were not as healthy as they should be, supply chain issues that have been exacerbated by the pandemic. Cybersecurity is an enduring issue, particularly for smaller companies. They gave the sector pretty high marks on competition, although I think you really have to caveat that by stating there are sectors in this market where there just aren't a lot of competitors. I mean, if you look at the defense industrial base in total, sure, there are a lot of people addressing it, but how many contractors are really capable of building combat aircraft or complex naval vessels? And I think the other part was the financial metrics. They're hard to, for me personally, they're really hard to pull together from the data that's available from publicly traded companies, because the publicly traded companies often commingle defense segment information with commercial segment information. And you're just not getting a complete picture of, frankly, what the financial state of a lot of the smaller companies that are the bread and butter of NDIA, what they're seeing. I think they're probably, if there are weak links in the supply chain, it's not the large publicly traded companies. It's a much smaller suppliers that they also address commercial aerospace markets that have clearly been impacted by the trauma that segment has seen.
But is that necessarily new? I mean, I remember the sector by sector, tier by tier assessment that our mutual friend Brett Lambert did when he was when he started at the Obama administration, right, at Industrial Policy, to get his arms wrapped around what are the vulnerabilities, what are the weak links, and finding that sometimes it's at the third and fourth tier where the entire sector depends on a little, for lack of a better word, mom and pop company. That becomes kind of a choke point. I mean, what do we know now that we didn't know before about the industry?
You're absolutely right. I think it's maybe, the environment is more stressed because, in healthier times for commercial aerospace, smaller contractors could rely on the strength and demand of the commercial aerospace segment, to keep capacity that was available ultimately for defense. But it's a really important question, Bago, and you and I have talked about this. We participated in events of this in the past where, if you really think about the ramifications of great power competition, the loss rates that you could see in a conflict, it really, I think, is a fundamental issue that DoD has to think through, which is how are you going to incentivize companies to keep spare capacity for the day, if and when you need it. These bottlenecks are really going to prevent us from rapidly responding to a contingency. And I think equally important, having that capacity to flux also has a deterrent value too. That if an adversary knows that, first couple of weeks of a conflict, you're going to lose platforms, but in the months that follow, you're going to be able to at least replace some of that capacity. That has a deterrent value that absolutely should get more hearing in this environment.
But there's an interesting yin and yang to this, right? On the one hand, modern industrial manufacturing machinery gives you greater flexibility to build many more different things, right? So, I mean, you get flexibility. You and I participated on a study about industrial, how the defense and national industrial bases can flex in the event of a national crisis, like a great power war. On the other hand, companies and the government have gotten so maniacal about, right? I mean, there used to be more elasticity in the system because there were more facilities. Companies were not as lean. They had extra people around that they could task to solve problems, which none of them have at this point, right? I mean, so what's the right way to
think?
And their
shareholders, you can go back and look at the Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman conference calls recently. I think the whole question of, hey, are you guys going to be shrinking your facility footprint? And that's been clearly part of the Raytheon Technologies merger with United Technologies as well, too. So, you know, the shareholders are demanding, hey, you got to become as efficient as you can and drive out some of these excess costs. Why are you keeping around these buildings that are only, 30% filled when again, you know, from an efficiency standpoint, losing that capacity, you know, in the kind of society environment we're in, I think it can't be easily turned on with a switch.
Indeed. But I also think, right, I mean, on each and every turn, we're finding that we got rid of too much infrastructure, right? I mean, right at the end of the Cold War, everybody was eager to get rid of these extraordinary dry dock facilities, engraving dock facilities that we had. And now we're finding, holy cow, you know, we don't have enough infrastructure out there to service the ships that we have in the fleet, much less grow or cope with numerous battle damaged ships, right? I mean, we had three destroyers the Fitzgerald and the McCain, and I think it was Port Royal, if I recall correctly. And together, they were sort of consuming an enormous amount of dry dock capability while we were repairing them, raising this issue, I know, for senior leaders who were wondering, like, wow, I mean, you know, if we had a couple of battle-damaged ships at once, could we handle that as well as the customary maintenance load we have? I mean, is there anybody who you think is doing thoughtful work on this, Byron? Right, to sort of, because,
you know, Mark Cassian at CSIS has talked about this. I think he put a report out not too many weeks ago about, you know, kind of attrition rates and great power competition. But no, I really haven't seen kind of a comprehensive what's the industrial capacity U.S. to handle this, what's allied capacity, and I think more importantly, or equally importantly, frankly, is, you know, China is the largest manufacturing country in the world right now. You know, I've seen very little, there's that whole concept of civil military fusion in China. I have no idea how they work mobilization strategies or how they even think about this stuff, but they've got the capacity and we better think through this as part of the whole dialogue and the thought process of great power competition.
This goes to the heart of something you and I have talked about a lot, which is, are we spending what we need to spend in order to do what it is we need to do, or are we trying to figure out kind of a cheaper way of seeing our way through it? And the concern I always have is that we have these overly optimistic projections on, we're not going to, I remember asking this question, 10 or 15 years ago. Hey, what if we're in a great power war and we're losing F-35s the way we were losing MRAPs? I remember you and I were having that conversation all the way back then, right? So, getting more realistic about it is certainly critical. Let's talk about M&A on mergers and acquisitions. Cubic Corporation, certainly one of the more interesting and innovative companies in the sector that does a tremendous amount of commercial business as well, is Brad Feldman, obviously one of the thoughtful CEOs, many thoughtful CEOs, but Brad certainly is an interesting thinker on this. And is doing one of the things that you've always prophesized, right? Take your company private, do not make it traded anymore, and that gives you greater strategic margin. Full disclosure, one of our sponsors is General Atomics, and General Atomics is a model when it comes to that, right? Makes long cycle plays in terms of investment that maybe it wouldn't be able to do if it was a publicly traded company. Talk to us about what this means, what it means for the sector, and how it could be a model for others to follow, especially since share buybacks are really reducing the amount of float that's out there.
Well, I think what it says, you have to look at the Cubic deal that was announced, as part of a string of deals that have been announced. I think it's fascinating that Veritas is again on the other side of the table here. They've got long experience in defense markets, and they bought the IT business at Northrop Grumman. It sold off, and then they were also involved in Perspecta, which was just taken private as well too. So it's intriguing. FLIR, you know, which has defense presence. It's probably considered more of a commercial diversified company, but they were purchased by Teledyne. That deal was announced earlier this year. So you have had this flurry of M&A activity, and it's maybe not too surprising because of the, you know, we now have some visibility about what the Biden administration, you know, we know there's going to be a Biden administration, although I'm not sure how many of these deals really hinged on whether it was going to be a Trump or Biden administration. There are two sides to every transaction. And clearly Veritas is thinking about, you know, making investments now that they'll be able to realize a return on, you know, in 2, 3, 4 years time. And to your point, it will be interesting, you know, if these companies no longer operate under the tyranny of meeting and beating quarterly earnings estimates, can they behave differently? They still have owners that are going to demand, you know, cash flows to pay down the debt that's been taken on for these deals. But, you know, it's just another change that I think is going to be important to factor. And it gets to another point, Vago, and that is there really is this continued hollowing out of publicly traded mid-sized companies in the defense sector. They're either private or, you know, they've been snatched up by the large primes.
Do you think, right, but I mean, the question is, we're always looking for, right, the next generation of innovation. Anduril is attractive because of that reason. For, you know, Tesla was under, SpaceX was under assault for a long time as being a Ponzi scheme, right? But it's a company that absolutely has changed spaceflight as we know it. Super Bowl was yesterday. Congratulations to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, as well as to the astonishing play of both Tom Brady and the Gronk coming out of retirement there. Although I have to say, Kansas City, there were some of those calls that were questionable on that, even though I think Tampa Bay played better football. I digress. One of the interesting commercials there was the fact that SpaceX is giving a flight away for civilians to get into space, to raffle this off for St. Jude's Hospital, which is just an extraordinary feat of charity, right? But this is a company that, you know, was a darling of markets, captured the imagination of Sean O'Keefe, who said, hey, you know what, the commercialization will be an important thing to drive down space launch costs, right? So, I mean, it takes vision. And you know, how many examples of that do we have of the little guy becoming a successful big guy, Byron?
No, I mean, I think that's been a constant issue. You know, the DoD has not really seen a company easily scale. And I think that's going to be critically important in attracting more capital and innovative companies to the sector. I mean, how many of these smaller enterprises get started up and then they're snapped up when they hit, you know, $15, $20, $30 million by some of the large primes? You know, SpaceX is arguably, I mean, it's not just defense, but, you know, they've kind of broken through that barrier of becoming a sizable player. You mentioned General Atomics, but that company, I think, was formed in the 1950s. And you know, rode the UAV wave, but you know, they really kind of had to knock down some doors to get the DoD to accept that particular weapon system. I think you know, maybe you could criticize the structure or the composition of some of these big companies that have started to make inroads in the DoD. Palantir, Anduril is the other we just mentioned a couple of minutes ago, SpaceX. You know, I think that it's going to behoove the DoD to try and find ways to scale companies that aren't run by billionaires. Because if that's the only way you can grow into a sizable participant in defense markets is have a billionaire founder backer, that's a pretty limited subset of the U.S. economy. And I just think, you know, I would hope that you can create larger freestanding companies that'll address some of the DoD needs, because I think it's good to have a vibrant, let me go back to this defense industrial base study I mentioned earlier, but you know, to me, the more competition you get, it's not necessarily that you're gonna lower costs all the time, but you're sure gonna get a lot more innovation.
I want to take you to another topic before we go. And this debate about whether or not $1.9 trillion in stimulus is the right amount of money. There are critics who say, look, it's much better. We just passed a nearly $1 trillion stimulus package. Let's pass something a little bit smaller, carry us over, address some of the specific issues we have. Let's means test in terms of the money we give to folks. There's an estimate that that is possible to do for about $900 billion or so dollars, and then keep powder dry and bipartisanship engaged in order to invest in defense, invest in national infrastructure and education that I would argue is as critical to the United States, to America's ability to compete with China and Russia. I mean, our infrastructure, a lot of it dates to the 1930s to the 1950s and the 1960s, you know, and we're lucky if we get to the 80s, right? I mean, a lot of this was you know, investment that was made a long time ago. What's your sense? And are folks missing the importance of the infrastructure investment as a key piece of America's national security? Because there's a tendency of just sort of thinking about it from the hardware side, as opposed to thinking about it strategically from a fundamental ability of the nation to compete over the long term, because it has the human and physical capital.
Yeah, I mean, my sense is, look, the $1.9 trillion plan has kind of left the station. You know, that's what the Biden administration wants. That's what's going to be in the reconciliation bills. You know, I think now it could still get tripped up here. I don't know if it's absolutely a done deal, but I would agree on a couple of different aspects that you raised. You know, first, it's important to note that the Biden administration does intend to unveil another larger plan. This was kind of the pandemic relief plan, and then they want to get a recovery plan going. I think the bigger question, you kind of allude to this, Vago, is, you know, are they going to spend so much capital, political capital, getting this $1.9 trillion plan through that it's really going to take the wind out of the sails on the relief plan? And that's going to be another tough one for them to sell. I agree on the notion that, you know, when you think of infrastructure, okay, it's not just pouring concrete and, you know, putting new asphalt down. I mean, it has workforce implications. I think the way the administration is talking about infrastructure, you know, you are talking about workforce development. This whole switch to electrification in vehicles has some really intriguing industrial base implications as well, too. And so I sometimes feel like the $1.9 trillion package, clearly there are people who are hurting right now who you know, need help. But, you know, if it's here, take a check. It does remind me of 2008, 2009. I don't know if that's necessarily good for the economy if, you know, there's a subset of people who, they go spend that check at Target or Walmart or Best Buy or something and buy stuff that's not necessarily made in the United States. It's helping the global economy, and I don't think that's the intent of it. So I think a far more focused relief plan that really, really got to the people who absolutely need this would be the ideal. I frankly don't know if DOD has the IT systems set up to make that fine a gradation and who actually should get this stuff. So for now, it's like, hey, you know, let's just shovel it out and, you know, we'll hit some of the people who need it and the rest, you know, hopefully by them going out and spending the money will do something broader for the economy. But does that really get to some of the things that the U.S. needs to be to do to be more competitive? No.
It's an interesting topic. I'm not an economist. I mean, it was interesting that the economic success the United States had after the banking crisis was because we put more money into stimulus and ended up making money, right, on those mortgages that we ended up buying, right, which was a lot like what happened during the Great Depression, when where the United States made money on this, or the Treasury did at the end of the day. And then there's this sense that because we were putting stimulus out, a lot more stimulus than anybody else around the world, our economic challenges are likely to be smaller. But the question is, right, we haven't used a lot of that $1 trillion yet. And I think stimulus can take many forms, and including defense investment, given that we actually have a lot of things we do need to invest in. I mean, you know, when you think about infrastructure, our military infrastructure in some cases is old. The nuclear enterprise infrastructure is old and in dire need of investment. And, you know, I mean, Dave Deptula reminds everybody all the time that the United States Air Force, the bulk of its equipment span from the 1950s to the 1960s to the 1980s in a lot of cases, right, with F-16s and F-15s, you know, having gone into the inventory, obviously, a long time ago.
You know, by the way, I think one of the interesting points about some of these massive federal stimulus programs, you know, I've got a book somewhere in my library about the fact that the Civilian Conservation Corps and the skills that were needed to organize that actually trained a lot of Army officers who then went on to become battalion commanders in 1942, 1943. And there were a couple of very interesting vignettes about, hey, what happens when you've got to move 1,000 people from Chicago up to the woods in Wisconsin, set up a camp and put them to work? And I just wonder if, you know, we sometimes, like I said, you think about this in terms of, you know, new roads and new railroad stations or whatever, but there's some people skills that come out of these efforts too that ultimately also contribute to, I call it, national resiliency.
That's a fantastic point, Byron. And at the end of the day, right, I mean, it also engenders sort of a sense of national service at a time when we worry about the civil military divide, you know, 1% of the country doing the fighting for the nation and the other 99% not being engaged in it. Yeah. Would be certainly something that might get folks engaged. So another great idea. Byron, thanks very much for joining us. Always an honor and pleasure having you on. Look forward to having you back on the roundtable on Friday and again and back again next week. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir, and thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.